Right then I realized we'd forgotten to tell the troops to bend at the knee at this point. Sure, it had been in the training vids the day before, but when you're on the spot and scared, you needed that final reminder. A few of them were bound to land with cracked legs. Shit. That was the last thought I had before getting slammed with terrific force. It felt as if twin giants had struck the soles of my boots with sledgehammers. Fired out of the launch cannon, I felt myself speed downward like a bullet. The invasion was on. Chapter 16. Landing was almost as traumatic as being loaded and dropped. The capsule spun around and fired retro jets. Again, my body was strained by G-forces. Impact foam had filled the cylinder after I'd been fired from Nostrum, so much so that I could barely move. My arms were pinned to my sides, and I hardly had room to cough. The only instrumentation data amounted to displays inside my helmet. That fed me velocity, range, and other info I couldn't do anything about. The capsule itself was like a tomb. For most of those who dropped today, it would literally become their coffin. Almost without warning, the base of the capsule slammed into the satellite. Before I could get out, I felt something give under my feet, and I almost panicked. Reflexively, I squeezed the handles that blew the capsule's explosive bolts. The hatch flew away from me and rang against a distant surface. Ripping away shreds of protective foam, it was like being born again. I staggered away from my capsule. I was inside the factory. That had to be it. Above, a hole had been punched in the roof. Below me, a deep dent had been made in the deck, and my capsule smoked in the depression. As I watched, the capsule began to drop deeper, having penetrated the deck under my feet. I was just about to contact my platoon when disaster struck. I was yanked forward off my feet. It took me a second, but then I realized I hadn't disconnected the emergency hoses that had attached my helmet to the capsule. Damn, I wasn't with it today. Pulled prone on the deck, I was dragged toward the dark hole in it. I frantically slashed the connective tubes, and I was free. I stood up again, panting. On my general unit channel, I relayed what I'd experienced. Normally, we landed on hard earth and didn't have to worry about our capsules falling into lower decks. I wasn't sure how many troops could hear me or would understand the message, but I figured I'd try to pass it on. "Is that you, McGill?" a voice crackled in my ear. "Harris, where are you?" "Damned if I know. We punched through the hull, and were driven like hammered nails down to what has to be the third deck. Hell of a thing." "Any contact from Winslade or Leeson?" "Nothing. But I've got a fix on you now. You're right above me." I got down on my belly and peered through the hole in the deck at my feet. Down there I saw Harris and a few other troops. They all looked dazed. Then a hulking figure appeared, bigger than all the rest. It was a heavy trooper. How had they squeezed him out of the drop cannons? I wasn't sure. Until I saw his oversized capsule. Apparently they'd spent some money on upgrades to Nostrum I hadn't been aware of. We soon sorted out our platoons, what was left of them. Harris had 20 survivors, half of them human and half of them blood worlders. I, on the other hand, had fared worse. I had 9 recruits and veteran Mahler left. That was it. "Splat," Harris said, laughing as he counted my troops. "You lost more than half? That's pathetic." "Rough drop for first-timers," I said. "They didn't all seem to get the part about popping out of their capsules the moment they landed. I figured we'll pick up more as we go deeper." We both gathered up more men over the next 10 minutes. That left each platoon short a few. But then we ran into a new problem. We found Winslade and Leeson, who'd dropped with him. They were both as dead as doornails, as were most of the weaponeers and other specialists. I reported into Graves immediately. "Apparently, sir," I said, It wasn't their drop technique. They punched through the outer hull of the factory, but then they landed in a crucible of molten metals. It was just bad luck, I guess.
Shit, Primus Graves said. All right. You've got operational command of your unit. It's at half strength already. I might merge you up later.
Got it, sir. Any change to our mission parameters?
No. Advance to the crew quarters and secure it.
On it, Primus. McGill out.
When I closed the channel, I looked up to see Harris giving me the evil eye.
What?
I asked him.
You planned that, didn't you? You called in, and he gave you command over me.
Grow up, Harris. I've got seniority at the officer level anyway.
But not in total years of service, not by a long shot.
You can call Graves and lodge a formal complaint after we take our objective.
Harris grumbled bitterly, but he followed me with his team of heavies. I knew he wouldn't call Graves. He wouldn't have gotten anywhere with that. We both knew it. Graves wasn't overly concerned with petty squabbles between ranks. He wanted things done and done right now. That's all he cared about.
The trouble with finding the crew quarters on this factory was it had been built by aliens. As humans were from Imperial territory, we were accustomed to working with markings, computer interfaces, and equipment controls that looked a certain way. This station was sized right, and it looked like humans could work here without a problem. But the aliens that built the place had their own ideas about things like signposts. Every hatch had a cube above it. That cube was a different color on every side, and some of them lit up more than others. I could tell right away that this was their form of writing. The format impressed me, as it was very compact. All you had to do in order to derive information was study a single three-dimensional object.
What the hell is that supposed to be?
Harris complained. Some kind of colored light?
No, I said, and I explained my theory. Harris was alarmed.
I'm calling Natasha over here. There's no way we can find our way through this maze following funky backlit cubes.
Natasha was our smartest tech specialist. She joined us and studied the lit cubes.
Such an ingenious system, she marveled. Think about the data compression. I see at least 10 color variations with 6 possible sides to display. That gives you 10^6 power, 1,000,000 permutations right there. That's just if you assume the colors aren't being used more subtly. Then, for added meaning, you've got some sides of each cube that are lit more brightly than others. Emphasis? An accent? We can only...
I said, interrupting. Hey, that's all great, but we need to know what these signs mean, like, now.
She looked at both of us, startled.
I've got no idea. Not yet. I'd have to study them. Examine the contents of every locker, chamber, or deck with a symbol above it. Then, when it's all become input into a computer database, I'll run an inference engine through it and...
Okay, I said, sighing. For right now, we've got no idea. We're flying blind.
We can follow tradition and logic, Natasha suggested. The crew quarters should be in a safe region, one that's centrally located with regards to the life support and workspaces.
I extended both my arms and pointed in either direction down the passage.
Which way?
Best guess?
She asked.
Sure, if that's all you've got.
Okay. Head down stairways. Go that way, spinward around the planet. The radioactive regions are behind us. Let's leave those behind.
We did as she suggested. What did we have to lose? The station was huge. All over it, human troops were crawling like ants exploring a train wreck. We damaged the outer hull with our landing pods, but the wounds weren't fatal. For the most part, the station seemed to run itself. But it couldn't entirely be automated. There were too many signs of biotic habitation everywhere.
Atmospherics? I asked Natasha.
She shrugged, working her instruments.
We can breathe here. The O2 is a point or two on the low side and the argon is high, but it's not dangerous.
Good enough, I said, opening my faceplate. That was a mistake. The air was acrid. It put a funny taste in my mouth and my nostrils.
It wasn't the argon, a gas you couldn't really detect. It was the industrial waste. All these hot machines and boiling vats. Smells like hell itself, I said. But I don't think it's poisonous. Unit, open masks and turn off respirators for now. They all did so, sniffing tentatively. Many coughed and grimaced, but they soon got used to it. If we could breathe their air, we could save suit power and our oxygen supply. That would make us last longer if we needed it later. We checked every room, every compartment. True to her word, Natasha cataloged the colored cubes and the contents behind them. Soon, a few patterns began to emerge.
James, Natasha said, forgetting to call me adjunct in her excitement. I've got some data points. 3 pinks and any other combo is a small compartment, a storage locker. We can ignore those hatches.
Good deal, I said, and relayed the instructions to the rest of the troops. What else?
Black seems to mean danger. Every time that color comes up, there's an exposed electrical conduction system or a volatile chemical involved.
That just figures, Harris complained, scowling. Carlos laughed. He was working with Natasha doing biotic measurements, looking for trace genetic material. These aliens are clearly very perceptive, right, Adjunct Harris? Ortiz, Harris ordered. Get back to the front of the line with your fart-sniffing machine.
Carlos scuttled off, and Natasha followed him. When we were alone, Harris faced me.
This is hopeless. This complex has at least 1,000 kilometers of passageways. We can't even read their signs, and the place looks deserted.
Yes, I agreed. You're right. But think, what if you were working on a huge industrial station and an alien ship showed up? Wouldn't you sound an alarm telling your workers to move to a safe location?
Maybe. But where?
I slapped his shoulder plate with my gauntlet. That's what we're supposed to find out. I marched off after Carlos and Natasha, while Harris followed, muttering foul words. When I reached them, they'd stopped walking and were listening to something intently. It was their tappers. Frowning, I leaned close. Was that a crying sound? A whimpering?
Civilians? I asked.
I don't think so, Carlos said. Natasha is picking it up, but we can't. The signal is faint.
Have you tried to talk to whoever is bawling on the radio? I asked her.
Natasha waved me to silence. Reluctantly, I obeyed. Turning up the volume, she let us all hear what she was hearing. The sounds were disturbing, creepy even. The sounds of a woman or a child, grieving quietly in the dark. I got a feeling of loneliness and despair.
There's no way to talk to them, Natasha said. It's half duplex. It's like they're broadcasting on a faint wavelength with the mic keyed open.
The sounds went on and on. They sent a chill through me. Such unhappiness couldn't last forever. Could it be a repeated recording? Now and then it faded, but soon it rose up again. It was like the distant song of a forgotten ghost locked in a closet.
That's just friggin' weird, Carlos said.
Turn it off.
No, I said.
Triangulate, give me a fix. We'll head to the spot.
Carlos looked at me in alarm. Hey, big guy, let me give you a little advice.
Carlos was only a specialist, but we'd been together since we joined Varus on the same day. Because of this, I let him get away with things the rest of the rank and file wouldn't dream of.
What?
I asked, knowing full well I was going to regret the question.
Let our ghost child go. Let it lure in some other sap.
You think that's what it is? A ghost?
It's a trap, he said firmly. Something created to demoralize us or to lure us closer.
I said, giving his thoughts actual credence. You could be right, but it's also the only damn lead we've got. We're going to find it.
Carlos sighed and shook his head. I tried. I'll always tell it that way. No one can convict me.
Chapter 17. My entire unit had broken up into small search parties looking for whatever we could scare up. In my own case, I decided to take Carlos and Natasha along to investigate the odd signal Natasha's computer was picking up. If we did find a person, it only made sense to have my chief medical and chief technical person with me. While we were searching for the source of the odd crying sounds being broadcast from somewhere in the complex, we found the security center. All around us, big displays showed what was happening. The cameras were small. We hadn't even noticed them as we advanced through the passages. But the displays, they were perfect.
"Wow," Carlos said, marveling. "This is better than a sensor round ride back home."
"You can see they're intelligent," Natasha said.
"Intelligent?" I asked.
"Who do you mean, the aliens who run this thing?"
"Not just that. The cameras. They only pick up unusual activity. Watch."
I did for a few moments, and I began to understand what she was talking about. The cameras weren't just motion sensitive. They didn't bother to capture moments that weren't repetitive, such as the movement of large machinery. As a result, we were watching primarily images of our own troops moving around the complex, searching it.
"It's all about us," Carlos said.
"What about the signal?" I asked. "Where's it coming from?" Natasha worked to isolate and pinpoint the source. Attached to the security center, we found a set of detention cells.
"A prison," Carlos said. "This just keeps getting better."
I led them down deeper into the brig. All the cells were open, except for one. That single unit contained shreds of clothing, what looked like human clothing. We couldn't get into the cell, but I reached my long arms in through the bars. The rest of my search team stood around making hissing sounds of distress. It was as if they expected something awful to grab onto me, but it didn't. Pulling back the clothes, I found a tapper, of all things. Now that's a bad thing to find all by itself. Our tappers are symbiotic. They live on us. They feed on power from our body's electrical fields. They can't be ejected by pressing a button. They're more than surgically implanted. Dried blood, shreds of desiccated flesh, and some stringy things I couldn't identify dangled from the tapper. I pulled it back with the dress, because that's what the scrap of clothing seemed to be, and presented it to Natasha and Carlos.
"They ripped out some girl's tapper?" Carlos asked. "That is sick."
"A human captive here?" I asked.
"Can you verify this, Natasha?" She was working her equipment. Her lips were curled back, but she didn't shy away. She took samples, ran them into tiny compartments in the tech computer in her ruck, and started nodding.
"The remains are human," she said, wiping her face with the back of her wrist.
I wasn't sure if she was pushing off tears or sweat, and I didn't have the heart to ask.
"Female, not too badly decayed. She must have recorded this, and when her tapper tried to connect with ours, it broadcast the message."
"A lot of good will do us," Carlos complained. "Sobbing? No words? That's her last message?"
I cuffed him. Sometimes I react physically, and this was one of those times.
"Have some respect for the dead, Ortiz," I said.
"I tell you what, I'll put your ass behind these bars and rip your tapper off with some pliers. Then we'll see what your last will and testament sounds like."
Grumbling, he sidled away.
Natasha was running more tests on the remains.
"I think she is dead. But this is disturbing. I'm not getting a clear ID from this tapper."
Suddenly, she turned to frown up at me.
"James, I think this person, whoever she wasn't from Earth. She doesn't have a valid tapper ID."
"Huh. No way to revive her, then. No way to find out who she was. A strange thing."
"With all due respect, Adjunct," Carlos said from a safe distance, "I think we should get the flying fuck out of here."
I looked at him. "You're probably right, but I'm not done looking around yet. We found a hatch that led below this level, and I marched down it.
James, Natasha called from behind me. We're getting pretty far from the rest of the unit.
I looked back. Natasha and Carlos were still at the circular entrance of this latest, smaller passageway. They didn't want to follow. They didn't want to go any deeper, I could tell.
Spooked, huh? I asked. All right. I'll just trot down this way and see where this tunnel goes. After that, we'll go back up. You two can hold on to your panties and sit at the entrance.
They were annoyed, but not annoyed enough to follow me. The passage was narrow. It was only about a meter and a half in diameter, and I had to hunch forward in order not to scrape my helmet on the ceiling. At last, I reached a big pressure hatch, and I forced it open. There, inside the chamber, at the end of that long, weird tube, was a junction, a larger chamber that led off in several directions to other passages. Some of the other passages were much larger than the one I'd used to access this chamber. In the center of the chamber was the power generator. It was a very alien-looking device. It spun constantly inside of a metal cage, but without actually moving physically. Instead, a ball of light whirled around on a spindle that looked like a shaft of diamond. The energy ball shot out bolts of power every second or so, like a storm caught inside a cage. Natasha, are you getting this? I asked, talking into my tapper.
I see, Natasha said, cutting out with static. Possibly dangerous.
Yep, looks deadly to me.
That's definitely a power generator, Natasha said in my ear.
She was reading my vid feed and watching my every move from a safe distance.
I can't fathom how it works from here, but I'd love to run tests on it.
You're welcome to come on down here and investigate.
Hold on a second, Carlos interjected. I've got a message from Graves. It says we're all to report back to the main decks. We've got incoming hostiles.
What? I complained. Did you just phone up Graves and tattle on me, Ortiz?
I'm sorry, sir, I'm not reading you clearly. Should I forward a shot of your middle finger to the Primus? I've got one on file here.
You chicken shit, I complained.
Natasha, is Carlos full of crap or what?
Specialist Ortiz is indeed exploding with excrement, sir, she said. But in this case, he's right. Graves is recalling all scouting parties. We've got assault ships inbound from the planet below.
Damn it, I said, and I rushed out of the chamber.
You guys return to the unit back the way we came. I'll meet up with you soon enough. I'm taking a different route back.
You're just not going to be happy until you die down here, are you, McGill? Carlos asked.
That's right, I admitted, and I closed the channel.
Finding a much larger passage, I was able to move faster. Bounding along in low G, I raced back to the upper decks. Taking a different route allowed me to do more scouting, too. I took photos of strange rooms, and once I even found remains of a dead Vulbite. Taking a quick snap of that, I relayed it up my chain of command. I got a call back from Primus Graves, but it wasn't a personal chat line. It was a message broadcast to everyone in the cohort who was able to access command chat. Apparently, I'd gotten close enough to the Legion routers to pick up messages like this again.
Listen up, officers, Graves said. We've got inbound hostiles. ETA 6 minutes. They're coming up from the planet, and their ships are moving too fast for Nostrum's broadsides to lock onto. Turov has opted not to fire, as the fusion shells would likely miss and hit either the factory or the planet itself.
That made sense to me. Nostrum's weaponry was built to either knock out an enemy capital ship or destroy a planet. We didn't have much in the way of armament designed to surgically take out small ships at range. Moving as fast as I could, I bounced along the passages back to my unit. Each flying leap caused my helmet to scrape and squeak on the ceiling, slowing me down. I cursed and tried to time it all perfectly, but it was hard. I wasn't used to the low-G environment yet.
Chapter 18. When I made it back to my unit, I motioned wildly to veteran Mahler. She approached, and I shared the feed from Graves with her. As Graves talked, her eyes widened in alarm.
We can only assume,
he said, that these assault ships are part of a counter-invasion force sent to repel us. Reports are the ships are full of Volbites. That's not confirmed yet, but several sightings support the idea.
I wanted to speak up and ask questions, but there were too many people listening in, so I kept my mouth shut for now. Let him finish, I told myself. What I did do was motion to Mahler again. Gather up, everyone, I ordered her. Pull in all our scouts. We're changing plans. Nodding, she rushed off and began bellowing orders at her startled recruits.
The third cohort, Graves continued, is hereby ordered to shelve our previous search and secure mission. We're moving out onto the outer hull, to the superstructure in open space. We've got the space docks covered by another cohort, so don't worry about them slipping in that way. The enemy forces will have to land and crawl into any available hatch, but to do that, they'll have to get past us first.
My lower jaw jutted out in thought. The plan seemed like a good one. It looked like the aliens had evacuated the complex when they saw us coming and we'd snatched the entire orbital structure by surprise. But now the enemy was finally in the game. They'd mobilized their troops and began staging a counterattack. There was going to be resistance after all.
This is what we get paid for, Graves said. Don't let a single enemy trooper sneak aboard our prize. You now have 15 minutes left to deploy on the roof. Graves out.
My helmet had lit up inside with new mapping information and waypoints for my team to reach. It was pretty general, and the map was blank in a lot of places, but we definitely had to backtrack several decks upward. Natasha grabbed my arm at that moment. Her eyes showed amazement.
James, I can't believe you made it back here before we did.
I'll tell you all about it sometime. For now, we're going up onto the roof. Check your HUD. Natasha did, and she cursed aloud. That wasn't the norm for her, but I understood. I'd relayed the predicted enemy landing points and our defensive line graphics to her.
We don't have time to get up there and set up an effective defense.
Not if we keep standing around here jawing, I agreed. Mahler and I got people moving, but our redeployment wasn't going as fast as I'd have liked. Many exploratory teams hadn't returned yet. Harris rushed up to me a few minutes later.
McGill, he said, I've got all my people back here.
He did, too. A dozen or so hulking giants were wandering in to stand behind him, and armored men clustered behind that.
Where's the squid? I asked him. Silt, he's somewhere.
Sub-veteran Silt, I called out over unit chat. Show yourself or I'll have to call you AWOL. Silt drifted into the chamber. In the low artificial gravity fields, it was easy for him to glide around almost like he was swimming.
What are your orders, adjunct? He said.
You're staying with me. Sargon, you're staying with me, too. 3 steps behind Silt here. Sargon had survived Leeson's deadly fall into the Crucible and had joined our platoon. He had a belcher and a sour attitude to go with it. I caught his eye and I nodded toward the squid.
Sure thing, sir, he said, and he moved behind Silt.
Sargon had been at my side for so many years I barely had to give him specifics. Sometimes just a look and a nod was good enough for us to communicate. In this case, I didn't trust Silt, and he knew it. I was just fine with Sargon. There was no way he'd ever trust any squid, unless that squid was already dead, and maybe not even then. Silt's eyes slid to track Sargon, then came back to me.
What is it I can do for you, adjunct? He said.
You can guide me and the remains of my unit. Get us up onto the roof of this structure as fast as possible. Check your data stream for details. I relayed Grant's mapping data to him.
The exterior? I see, he said. We'll be on the side facing the planet's surface. That will leave us vulnerable to enemy cannons.
Whatever, Harris said, losing patience. Can you get us there in 4 minutes?
Yes, Silt said.
Then, bunching his thick tentacles, he sprang away. He shot off, gliding vertically to the ceiling of the chamber we were in.
Now, adjunct?
Mahler demanded.
Now, I ordered.
Magnetics off,
Mahler shouted. In unison, we turned off our magnetic boots and sprang after the squid. Legion Varus troops like Harris and I were experienced spacers. We weren't as smooth with null G maneuvers as a squid, but we were pretty damn good. But the same couldn't be said for our fresh recruits or our heavy troopers. They all preferred the feel of something solid, like a ship's deck, under their boots. All of the experienced Varus officers and non-coms flew like birds. We didn't hesitate or tumble. In a surprised rush, the recruits and heavy troopers tried to follow. Some of them did pretty well. Cooper, for example, managed a controlled swan dive, with his hands stretched out on either side of him. The heavy troopers were the worst. They moved like falling boulders. They didn't flail, but instead sort of hunkered into a ball, often spinning slowly. When they hit the upper part of the chamber, they landed on their heads, sides, or feet at random. Sad it was for the light trooper who didn't skitter out of the way fast enough when they came sailing in. A few cries of pain were heard, and none of the heavies apologized for crushing my lights. There wasn't time for recriminations. Silt was still on the move. He'd levered up a hatch and vanished into it. I was right on his tail, along with Sargon and Harris. Turning to Harris and Mahler, I nodded to the clown posse of noobs on our tail. Ride herd on 'em. Don't let them straggle. Then, with a nod to Sargon, I launched myself into the hatchway. We were hard on Silt's tail, or rather his aft tentacles. Once, after taking two or three more rapid turns, Silt glanced back. Sargon and I were right there. He paused as if surprised.
"Do you wish me to slow down?" he asked.
"If I do, I'll give you the order." One of those trailing tentacles twitched. Was that annoyance? Some latent desire to reach out and slap this irritating human? I wasn't sure, but Silt turned away again and swam higher, heading toward the outer decks. After a bewildering series of hatches, passages, and wide-open chambers, we finally reached a large airlock.
"Open space lies beyond," Silt said. "Should I open it?"
"It's pressurized in here," I said. "We'll be sucked outside." The squid rippled his dangling limbs. I'd learned this was a sign of unconcern on his part, a cephalopod shrug.
"Boss," Sargon said, "when the unit comes in here, we'll have to cycle through that airlock. We've only got about a minute left. I don't think we'll have the defensive line organized before the enemy shuttles get here."
"Yeah," I said. "All right, hang on. Silt, blow both doors." Looking mildly surprised, the squid tapped a sequence of buttons. Right then, I realized something. Silt had been here before. Either that or he knew how to operate this equipment because the interface was familiar. It hadn't occurred to me to mine him for information, as he'd been part of Harris's command. I made a mental note to ask him about the colored cubes and a half dozen other things later on, when we weren't about to go into a pitched battle. The door shunted open with shocking speed, and the released air sucked at our bodies hard, but the effect was brief. One recruit was caught by surprise, however. Our first light trooper came up into the chamber just as the doors opened. Taken by surprise, Cooper was propelled by an explosive gust of air. He went flailing by. "Snag him, somebody!" I shouted. We all reached, but only one of us had the length of limb to do the job. Silt caught one ankle, and Cooper slammed into the steel bulkhead with bone-cracking force. The pressure had equalized by now, and I gestured to Silt, who tossed Cooper toward me carelessly. I caught the kid and checked him out, frowning. His helmet had a star-like crack, but it was intact. His face, he wore a comically shocked expression.
"Ha!" I laughed. "You still with us, Cooper?"
"Yes, sir. I think so. I might have cracked a rib, but I'm alive."
"Good to hear. I like your spunk. You're going to scout the exterior hull for me. Right now."
He moved painfully at first, but soon he was crawling over the metal hatch like a spider. He was back in the game. Mean, but tough. Part of me liked the kid. Sure, he was the biggest asshole I'd met since Carlos, but he had spirit. While he scrambled outside in the blue-gray light of the planet, the chamber behind us filled with troops. The heavies came in last, squeezing their bulk past the hatchways, looking like grown men negotiating tunnels made for children. I saw a flash outside. "Cooper!" I shouted. "Report!" Silence returned to me. I remembered his broken antennae. Maybe the kid was having trouble with his comm system through the thick hull. Silt, can you see him? The squid gave me an unpleasant stare.
Not without exposing myself.
Expose yourself, then, briefly. Squids are big and bulky aliens, but in space or water they're pretty fast-moving and even graceful. They only seemed to move with lumbering slowness when they were on dry land under the solid tug of gravity. Silt lunged past us into the open airlock. After about 2 seconds, he returned again. He trailed Cooper's broken body behind him. Cooper no longer had to worry about his broken antennae, his starred faceplate, or much of anything else. His head had been burned clean off. His neck was a charred black stump. That's all he had left of his most important appendage.
Chapter 19. My light troopers were scared. I couldn't blame them, what with Cooper's beheaded corpse drifting around in the middle of the chamber we were hiding in.
"Looks like we have company," I announced. "Natasha, relay the contact report to Graves."
"Aren't you going to ask him what to do next?" she asked. "We're pinned in here."
I looked at her, startled. "Nope. I know what he'll say. Get yourself unpinned or something equally helpful."
"What are we going to do then?" Harris asked.
For 2 quick seconds, I thought about it. I've never claimed to be a smart man, but even an average man often has natural areas of expertise. One of my specialties, developed over many years, was a good feel for small unit tactics. "Light troops, gather up," I shouted. Mahler herded her charges forward, and they were soon clustered all around the open airlock like rabbits hunkered down in a hole.
"You're just gonna send them up there in a surge?" Harris asked, sounding doubtful.
The light troopers were all fresh recruits, and they looked like they were shitting in their pressure suits. "Nope," I said. "Not exactly. Get your heavy troopers to gather farther back. They're wave two."
"Wave two?"
Harris asked, spitting the words.
"You're gonna lose them all at once in a single flash of glory, is that it?"
"Shut up," I said, without anger. I was watching what we could see of the hull outside. "Natasha, send out your buzzers."
"Already done,"
she said, and she relayed her data stream. I watched, but I didn't see much. A dozen or so drone bugs were crawling over the skin of the ship. They couldn't fly, at least not easily, as they had wings and there wasn't any air out there. What little propellant they carried would be wasted fast if I had them use it. "Send one high," I ordered. She did, and I watched as it did a slow, panning spin. The scene outside was mostly dark. A few areas were catching the dim sunlight of the brown dwarf, which really looked more like a reddish coal in a dying fire. The planet reflected some light up, too, as it was day down there, and the cloud cover was bouncing a few rays up to us. For a few seconds, I didn't see anything other than the usual external clusters of nozzles, vents, hatches, and the like. Then, during the buzzer's second slow, panning spin, I caught sight of movement. The motion vanished a second later, and the equipment-festooned surface appeared empty again. "Freeze that image right there," I ordered Natasha. She did so, deftly. Then she enhanced the few frames we'd caught and redistributed her new version.
"Is that some kind of flatworm?" Harris said in disgust.
"No," I said, thinking about where I'd seen these things before. "No, they're Vulbites. They must be cloaked." Back on Blood World, I'd met several species in combat that were new to me. Among them were the Vulbites. Big, insectile creatures. They were centipedes the size of tigers.
"I remember those sneaky pricks," Harris said. "That's why we can't see them. They're probably cloaked, crawling all over the hull, waiting for us to come out to play."
"Right," I said, thinking hard.
"What are we gonna do?"
Carlos asked me. He drifted up from somewhere in the back.
"They'll get in close and drop a charge in here soon. They know we're here."
He had a point. We'd expelled a lot of gas and fed Cooper to them.
They had to be closing in.
Wait, I said, watching the buzzer feed closely. Don't attack until my signal, then the lights will spring up with heavy troopers right behind them.
We waited a full minute. Natasha's buzzer still spun, and I watched for signs. But I saw nothing.
McGill,
Gray's voice was in my ear. I cursed quietly and opened a channel. I kept my eyes glued to the buzzer's feed.
Yes, sir, I reported back to Graves.
What's the goddamn holdup? I can see you've reached the outer hull. Only two others have made it that far. And you're just squatting in cover.
I angled my tapper to give Graves a good view of Cooper's corpse. It was slowly bouncing along the bottom of the chamber.
We've made contact, sir.
Your orders are to defend that region. Don't let them into this complex, McGill.
I'm on it, sir.
Graves grunted unhappily, but he stopped short of ordering me to attack immediately. I'd hoped he'd give me some leeway. In Legion Varus, the general rule in such engagements was to give the commander in the field the right to follow his orders with whatever edits he felt were necessary. If the higher-ups didn't like how a commander handled things, they could relieve him of command and find someone better. Graves finally disconnected with a growl. It was a relief, really. It was hard to pay attention to him and watch the buzzer feed like a hawk at the same time. One more minute passed before things broke. By then, the enemy force had to be close at hand. They could move stealthed, but if they attacked us, they would be visible, at least briefly. Back on Blood World, they'd engaged us with large swords, but here in space, that wasn't really feasible. You couldn't get leverage for a powerful strike without some decent gravity. At last, I saw what I was looking for. It wasn't a Vulbite. No glint of a sword or a shimmer of moving feet gave them away. What happened instead was another unit, probably the fifth, which according to my tactical maps had reached their contact point, decided to deploy in a rush. A large team of lights went out first, taking the lead. There were at least 30 of them, and I envied their commander for having a full-strength unit. They bubbled out of a hatch about 100 meters away and spread out, advancing. I thought about warning them, but it was too late. Maybe they knew what we were up against anyway, as I'd shared my buzzer feed with the whole cohort. 30 seconds after they made their move, the Vulbites answered it. The invaders shed their cloaks and opened fire in unison. The light troops taken by surprise were hammered with bolts of plasma. The bolts were visible when they struck metal, which was everywhere. Light troopers exploded, firing puffs of pink steam out of their backs, which immediately froze into vaporous ice crystals.
Now, I roared. Lights up, engage immediately, full auto!
The other unit that had been surprised had hunkered down and begun to return fire, but they weren't having much luck. The Vulbites outnumbered them, had the drop on them, and possessed superior weapons and training. A few Vulbites pitched into space, flailing, but not many. My own lights advanced with speed. I had to give them that. They had heart. The poor kids had to be terrified, but they were still game. Telling green troops to unload with a snap rifle always ended with the same spectacular results. The Vulbite line was caught from the flank, having turned away from our lifeless hole to face the enemy at hand. Several were shot to pieces. Then, my heavy troopers crawled up out of our hole. I followed them with Sargon, my officers, and the armored troops bringing up the rear. We fell on the Vulbites, and they tried to escape. Some wrapped themselves back up in their silvery, net-like stealth cloaks. Others got down low, legs churning, and scuttled for cover. But it didn't do them much good. We shot the ones that had cloaked by spraying the area with fire. It was hard to cover oneself in a mesh blanket while under a hail of incoming bullets. Really? We were spraying for all we were worth. A few of them might have managed to float or sneak away, but not many. We killed most of them by advancing from two sides, my unit and the other across from me, cleansing the hull of the enemy. After the battle was over, a stocky centurion walked over to greet me. He was a man named Manfred, and I liked him. We clasped gauntlets briefly.
"Adjunct McGill," he asked, "where's Winslade?"
"Died in the drop, sir."
Manfred laughed. I'm not surprised. That walking puke bag has been in the service for nearly 30 years, and he still splats on combat jumps. They should never have given your unit that loser. Thank you, sir. He looked at me. Don't sir me. You earned Centurion once, and you'll earn it again.
Thanks, Centurion. I caught a flash of a smile through his faceplate.
We're proceeding to point, he told me. You report this action to Graves. Go ahead and leave my name out of it.
Manfred swaggered away, and I smiled after him. He was the opposite of some officers. Far from being a glory hound, he liked to see credit bestowed where it was due. Taking his suggestion, I reported directly to Graves.
Good deal, Graves said. Yes, I can see you're finally at your waypoint. Vulbites, you say. All our reports have been confirmed. Makes sense anyway, but not in a good way. The Rigelians must know about this facility, and apparently they beat us out here.
I agree, sir, I said. I would guess the Vulbite troops are fighting for the Rigelians, and they've already taken over this planet. The Vulbites are probably their local garrison.
Right. That's got to go up to Turov. We'll call in reinforcements. Hopefully ours will get here before theirs can.
Reinforcements, sir? The Legion is already deployed.
That was a misstatement, McGill. Forget you heard that.
Heard what, sir? My helmet is buzzing.
Good. Graves out.
For several minutes, we spread out over the hull, but I didn't put all my troops out there on the exposed surface. Over half went back down into the chamber below. After all, we didn't know what the enemy might throw at us next. I wondered, briefly, about what reinforcements Graves had been talking about, but not too much. I'd find out soon enough.
Chapter 20
For nearly a half hour, we remained at our post, uneasy but unmolested.
They can't have given up so easily,
Harris said for about the 15th time. I glanced at him as I put my back against a large flange of twisted metal that resembled a blown-up water tower. I doubt they have, but who knows? We've got 10,000 troops. They've got an entire planet. They might have more assault shuttles, or they might not. We'll see.
A worldwide garrison has to be bigger than our Legion,
Harris fretted, staring down at the dark planet below.
I hate this place already,
he said with feeling. When have you ever liked a planet we've invaded?
I like Death World, kind of, until those massive plants started eating us for snacks.
We laughed, sharing an old memory. Just then, I thought I saw a flicker. I snatched up my rifle, figuring the Vulbites might be back. They could move in stealth with their odd technology. We tried to duplicate it on Earth, but we'd failed thus far. Looking this way and that, I didn't see anything, but I remained tense.
Harris, did you see that? Looked like a flash of light.
Harris didn't answer. He was in an odd pose, languishing on his back. I heard a bubbling sound on my comm box. Then, tuning into unit-wide chat, I heard several similar examples. Low moans, the sounds of labored breathing and great pain.
We've been hit hard, I shouted. If you're able, retreat into the hatch.
A few troops dove for the yawning hole. One heavy trooper lumbered by, his magnetic boots sticking with every clumsy step. But before he could dive to safety, the sky lit up again. It was like the flicker of lightning, distant, silent lightning. The heavy trooper began to smoke. His back had been seared, melting his suit and his air hoses. Vapor exploded under pressure, and he began to flip and convulse, like a granddaddy bass in the bottom of a fisherman's boat. I grabbed him, pulling his vast bulk after me. If I hadn't been in a nearly weightless environment, I never could have managed it. Hauling my heavy trooper behind me, I joined dozens of others as we dove down into the darkness. Close the hatch, I ordered when everyone who wasn't registering as dead on my HUD was inside. The hatch closed and the air began to cycle back into the chamber, repressurizing it.
What the hell was that?
Carlos panted, popping open his faceplate. Plumes of mist flowed from his face with every word.
He began working on the man I'd brought in immediately. Carlos was our unit bio. "Probably some kind of long-range anti-personnel beam," I said. "It got Harris."
"What are your orders, Adjunct McGill?"
Silt asked me. The heavy troopers were sulking. They looked at the man I'd dragged behind me. He was one of their brothers, I realized. I nodded to Carlos. "See if you can keep him alive."
"Wouldn't it be just as well to finish him?"
Silt asked. The heavy troopers were watching this interaction, and they gathered around to stare at Carlos as he worked on their fallen comrade. "You know them best," I said. "You can make the call, Silt. Snuff him out if you think you should." I stood up and backed away, making a welcoming gesture to the cephalopod. Silt ruffled a bit, a clear sign of irritation. Was the squid trying to get me to upset the heavy troopers? I wasn't sure. These guys all thought like aliens from my perspective. It was hard to decipher what was what with any of them. But I was certain that watching me kill one of their men wouldn't be a good thing for morale, so I passed on the suggestion. Silt passed as well. He glided away to check on other things. Carlos watched him go. I gave him a quick hand gesture, meaning, "What's the deal?" We'd started doing that more often lately, as the heavy troopers came from a different culture, and they never understood these subtle communications. Carlos lifted one hand, thumb out. He began to turn it downward, but then reversed it and gave me a thumbs up. The heavy trooper was going to live.
"He's tougher than a regular human," Carlos said. "I sprayed him down with new skin like it was going out of style, and the wounds have sealed. I think either of us would have gone into shock and required critical care."
While he spoke, the heavy trooper rustled. Slowly, he got to his knees, and then to his feet. He wobbled a bit. I thought about reaching out to steady him, but I stopped myself. His own brothers weren't touching him. Maybe by their rules that would dishonor him or prove he was still weak. So I didn't touch him, and when Carlos reached for his massive elbow, I yanked him back. "Let the man stand on his own two feet. You see that? He's okay. He's good to fight." I started slamming my gauntlets together, clapping loudly. These litter-mates knew enough of our strange ways to understand it was a compliment. They soon joined in, clumsily beating their catcher-mitt-sized hands together. For the first time, the faces of the heavy troopers lit up. I could tell they were relieved. I wouldn't say they were happy, exactly. I wouldn't even say they smiled, because they didn't. But for them, it was like a standing ovation. The injured man limped away and found some food and drink. He sat painfully and consumed it. His eyes were glassy, but he wasn't passing out. "Good enough," I said. "We won the day." All of my troops looked at me in surprise at these words. I was pretty sure they all figured we'd gotten our asses whooped. But that isn't how I read things. "Look," I said. "We took this station, they counterattacked, but we held. That's called winning. Sure, we got our noses slapped a little, but that's to be expected. This is a war, after all." There was some ragged cheering. I could tell they didn't feel like winners. I walked around handing out praise and sounding cheerful. The stack of half-roasted corpses we'd dragged down here from the exterior hull, those who hadn't survived, I studiously ignored. Carlos came near after a few minutes, and he grinned at me.
"Noses slapped?"
he asked.
"It's more like we're still trying to pull Vulbite boots out of our collective butt cracks."
"Hush," I told him. "These troops are green. They need a little morale building.
Why didn't you just tell them not to worry, that they'd catch a revive if they died?"
"Because recruits never respond well to that kind of line. Hell, no one does. People don't like dying."
"So I noticed."
He walked off then, and I looked for Natasha. Sadly, I soon figured out she was among the dead. Several hours passed, and I got word that reinforcements were trickling back to our front lines from Nostrum. The first evidence of this came dramatically about 6 hours after we'd initially set boots down on this frigging space factory.
"McGill,"
a familiar voice boomed. I lurched and snorted awake. I'd nodded off while leaning back against a wall. "Primus Graves?" I asked, looking around and sniffing. Climbing to my feet, I noticed he had a small army behind him. The most significant of these included a party of 9 fresh littermates. They were heavy troopers, outfitted and ready to go. Only, I could tell right away, they weren't ready for action. I hadn't trained them for a month aboard Nostrum. No one had.
"Harris, Winslade, Leeson," Graves said. "They're all coming out of the revival queue soon. They'll move here to reinforce your position."
"Okay," I said, and I wanted to ask about the littermates who were missing their brothers, but I didn't dare. Instead, I dodged. "How'd you get down here so fast? And what's this team of noobs for?" Graves cinched up his brow.
"They're your reinforcements. Put them in Harris's team and crunch down your existing heavy troops into one group."
I glanced over my shoulder at the Blood Worlders. They were listening without comment, as usual. I said. "I don't know about that, sir. I've got 5 from one group and 6 from another. That's 11 who don't know each other, plus these 9.
"So what?"
Graves asked.
"We'll sort them all out when this campaign is over. Tell them that and line them up."
The new guys behind Graves were looking stern but bewildered. I got the feeling they were fresh off the training fields, either from Earth's camp up in Nova Scotia or from Blood World itself.
"Begging your pardon, sir," I said, "but I suspect these men haven't been trained in the ways of Legion Varus yet."
"That's where you come in. Stop complaining. We set up a pipeline from Earth to Nostrum, and now we've got a gateway down from the ship to this station."
"I get that, sir, but—"
"Listen, McGill,"
Graves said, taking a step closer and lowering his voice.
"Am I going to get grief from you? I don't need any of that, not today, not any day."
Sighing, I nodded. "Got it, sir. Don't worry about a thing. We'll make do."
"Good. More reinforcements will be trickling back. Take a break, unless the enemy shows up again."
"So, it's confirmed?" I asked. "We completely kicked them off the complex?"
"As far as we can tell, we have. This place is strange and huge. Who knows what might be hiding deep inside this maze of passages and chambers?"
I thought about the remains of the human prisoner we'd found. Who had she been, and how had she come to be all the way out here in deep space? I didn't know. This place had its secrets. Graves left and moved on, taking a long column of troops with him. He was apparently dropping some off at every post that had suffered losses against the Vulpites. Shortly after that, all of our officers returned. I was glad to see everyone, except Winslade.
"So," he said, swaggering up to me, "you survived the first round, McGill?"
"I did indeed, sir."
"Somehow I'm not surprised. You're a cockroach of a man."
The heavy troopers listened. The guys who'd been with me since I'd left Earth stood a little closer to me as they listened in on our conversation. I wouldn't have noticed, except for the fact they were about 3 meters tall. But when Harris showed up, they stopped crowding around. Harris shouted at them and the new guys as well. He made them line up, get counted, and individually report their status. Carlos sidled up while this went on.
"At least you don't have to play Mother Duck anymore."
"It's all right," I said. "These guys need direction, and they know it."
"More like they're clueless retards who—"
I slapped him one on the back of the helmet. It was reflex. I didn't like one of my men putting down the rest.
"What the hell?"
he asked, rubbing the back of his neck.
"That's the second time you smacked me in 24 hours. Have you gone sweet on these meatballs?"
Meatball was a term I was hearing more and more often. It was an unfortunate reality in every military organization that the troops would, sooner or later, invent derogatory terms for any and all subgroups. Meatball had become the word of choice in regards to the heavy troopers from Blood World. "They fight hard," I told him. "They follow orders, and they die like the rest of us. In fact, they're more likely to get perm than you are, so I respect their sacrifice all the more." Carlos had been at my side for decades. During that time, I don't think he'd learned as much as he should have. but I had noticed he'd come to understand when an officer was pissed off at him. Rubbing the back of his head, he walked off, sullenly, muttering something about me having strange bunkmates. Pretending I hadn't heard him, I turned back to the other officer.